this will be part three of Esther taking back what's ours. Once again, I've assigned each of the 10 chapters of Esther their own titles. Chapter 1, laying the groundwork. Chapter 2, the providence of God. Chapter 3, consequences of disobedience. Chapter 4, repentance. Chapter 5, putting faith to action. Chapter 6, the beginning of the end. Chapter 7, pitfalls. Chapter 8, retaliation. Chapter 9, the memorial. And chapter 10, exaltation. In the previous two messages, I've covered the first two chapters of the book of Esther and have just begun to cover chapter 3. Chapter 3, in verse 1, we're introduced to the villain of the story, Haman. Haman the Agagite. Haman the Amalekite. Haman the Edomite. Haman the direct descendant of King Agag, who along with his sons and other countrymen, King Saul, ancestor of Esther, failed to annihilate as he was commanded. Thus the title of this third chapter, Consequences of Disobedience. Again, the events recorded in the book of Esther would have never even occurred had King Saul not disobeyed God, or had King Saul obeyed God, because wicked Haman would have never even been born, being a direct descendant of King Agag. And I highly suspect neither would have most of the Hamans of today as well. From verse 1 of chapter 3, we covered verse 1 of chapter 3 in the last message. But also from verse 1 of chapter 3, I also ask you to note how Haman the Edomite positioned himself in a key advisory position in the government of King Ahasuerus. I also pointed out and demonstrated how nothing has changed, how we have our own Hamans today in key positions doing the same thing in government, with kosher conservatives such as Rush Limbaugh, and also within Judeo-Christian ministries and organizations. And I went through a list of different ministries, for example, that have Hamans that have positioned themselves, got involved, wriggled their way into those ministries and movements as soon as they became influential, and either in order to have an impact on where those ministries may end up going. I just received another this last Friday, another notice of one, Marshall Whitman, who is an Edomite Jew. It was reported that he is the executive director of Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. Now, I talked to James Brueggemann about it, and James said that he's actually the director of legislative research in Washington. Maybe he's been moved up, I don't know, but James was pretty certain that's what he is, but it doesn't matter. The point is, there's another one that's got his way in, another Haman who's positioned himself in a very influential position in order to influence not only what's happening in the government, not only what's happening on the world affair, but even within Judeo-Christianity. Surprise, surprise. Maybe a surprise to them, it's not much of a surprise to us. Here's the point. There's indeed nothing new under the sun. And don't miss this either. Esther was indeed written as an example for us and for our instruction upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Don't miss all that there's to be learned from the book of Esther. And I'll guarantee there's a whole lot more in it that I'm going to bring out. You know, I'll read it after I finish the series, and I'll guarantee I'll come up with something. I'm going to say, man, I wish I'd have seen that one, be able to share with you. Well, don't let this just take care of it for Esther. There's a lot in that, and of course a lot in the whole Word of God to be gained and learned no matter how many times you go through it, if you're open and receptive to God's direction in your life. Now, let's continue with the book of Esther, beginning with verse 1 of chapter 3. Esther chapter 3, beginning with verse 1, it says, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Therein the villain. Verse 2, and all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, does Mordecai remind you of anyone else found in the Bible? What we just read there? Go ahead. What'd you say? Daniel, anybody else? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of course. And Daniel as well. I believe that Mordecai, the Judahite, ranks right up there with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel. But seldom, if ever, gets the due that's, or gets his due. Period. How many times have you ever heard Mordecai mentioned in the same breath as those other Bible heroes? I've never heard him mentioned with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Daniel, or some of the others. I've never heard him mentioned in that fashion. I don't think that the consequences in his situation were any less serious or dangerous than those in Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego's, or in Daniel's case. Read the rest of the story, as we will. Don't pass over this lightly. Put yourself in Mordecai's shoes. Everyone, I mean everyone, was doing it. He was the only one who refused to bow down. At least in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's case, they had each other. They had a little support, a little moral support from two others, you know. But here's old Mordecai, all by his lonesome, as he refuses, even alone, to follow a multitude in doing evil. I don't know. Maybe old Mordecai ranks up just even a little bit higher than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, if you think about it, in a sense, each one of us really are in Mordecai's place. How many times are we faced with doing what everyone else is doing in contrast to what God expects us to do? Now, you might remind me that it's not quite the same. We're not usually faced with being put to death. Nevertheless, don't miss that doesn't change the fact that our decisions may still have eternal consequences, which are even worse, or could be worse. When you choose to follow the multitude rather than God, what have you done? When you've chosen to follow the multitude rather than God, what have you done? Let me tell you what you've done. You've done the same as Mordecai had he decided to literally bow down and worship Haman. It's no different. You've transgressed the first commandment of placing other gods before Yahweh. It's no different. You think about that the next time you're faced with a moral decision. When all the crowd, when all the peer group, when everybody else is doing it, you're faced with a decision possibly all alone like Mordecai was. And of course, even the day may come when we'll be faced with moral decisions, when death will be a part of the consequence. You young men here, and I should say maybe young lady as well, but how many times have you said to your folks, well, everybody else is doing it. Now, they probably aren't going to volunteer. Maybe I should ask the parents how many times they've heard it from you. Well, that's probably good reason in and of itself not to do it if everybody else is doing it. I'm going to tell you something. It's going to be a policy in my home. And as soon as one of my children say, well, everybody else is doing it, that will guarantee they're not going to do it. Because if everyone else is doing it, it's a pretty safe bet that it's not pleasing to God. Don't ever forget Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14. Where it says, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. And for the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. You say, well, I want to be a part of the crowd. Well, the crowd just may lead you to destruction. Probably very well will. But if you want to be a part of the elite, part of the elect, part of the remnant, you follow the narrow way. Find that small, narrow gate and follow through it. Verses 3 and 4. Verse 3, then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew / Judahite. Now, that's an interesting response. Mordecai certainly wasn't ashamed of his heritage. We talked about that in the previous chapter, how it almost would appear in one particular case that he was ashamed. He and Esther were ashamed of their heritage, which wasn't the case at all. As I pointed out, they were simply being wise as serpents and gentle as doves, using discretion in a touchy situation, you could say. There was no doubt. There's no doubt that Mordecai was not ashamed of his heritage. But why wasn't he ashamed of his heritage? What did it mean when Mordecai responded that he wouldn't bow because he was a Judahite? Well, let me assure you, in that response, he wasn't only declaring his physical lineage. He was confessing his responsibility as an Israelite. He was telling them that because he was a Judahite Israelite, that he served a different God under a different set of laws. It's the same for us today. That is, if we come back to the Father through the Son. But it's the same for us today. We serve a different God by a different set of laws. No other people, other than those, speaking back here in the context of Esther again, no other people other than the descendants of the 10-tribed house of Israel could have responded in such a way as Mordecai did when he said, why? When they said, why won't you bow? Because I am a Judahite. And I'm sure he said it with his head held high. Nobody else could say that other than other Israelites. Now, why do I say that? Well, because the following is said also of no other people. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 7. For what great nation is there that has so God near to it as Yahweh our God whenever we call upon Him? Or Deuteronomy 7, 6. For you are a holy people to Yahweh your God. Yahweh your God has chosen you to be a people for His own possession or special treasure out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. And also Amos 3, first part of verse 2. You only have I chosen out of all the families of the earth. They were the only people that had ever been said about. Consequently, they were the only people who could respond as Mordecai did. Now, don't try to tell me that the identity message doesn't make a difference. Yet, not because of who we are, but rather because of who we are in relation to who He is. There's a big difference. There's nothing for us to brag about. Nothing of all peoples. I mean, you look at our track record, our moral track record. There's nothing for us to brag about in our genealogy except that it's our genealogy that Yahweh has chosen. In that light, I often quote to myself Galatians 6 and verse 14, where it says, but may it never be that I should boast except in the cross of my Lord Yeshua the Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. May it never be that I should boast except in Him. I don't have anything to boast of, I'll guarantee you. You may not know what I was like before He touched my life, but I sure know. And I have nothing to boast of except by Him. But at the same time, Mordecai could have never have made his declaration had he not known his identity. And he probably also would have never made his stand had he not known his identity either. Think about it. There's some confidence, some courage that comes with knowing you're an Israelite, because with that knowledge, all the knowledge of who you are, comes the awareness of who your God is. The great, the mighty, the awesome God, as He's called. The one and only King of kings and Lord of lords. The Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I mean, when you know you're an Israelite, especially if a Christian Israelite, you can know who your God is. Let me tell you, I would not be as near as courageous as I am if I was a Canaanite or a Hittite or a Moabite or an Amalekite or an Ammonite. Would you? I wouldn't be near as courageous. We're Israelites. Not only that, we're Christian Israelites. So let's start acting like it. What then shall we say to these things? Despotic rulers, Antichrist edicts, crime bills, etc., 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 etc. And I'll guarantee you they'll come up with some more doozies in the times to come. But what shall we say to these things? If Yahweh is for us, who can be against us? What will mere man do to us? We're Israelites. And we are the only ones who can claim that. What a heritage. It's a part of our heritage. Again, that's been lost. And that we need to claim again as ours. And the knowledge of our identity should provide us with confidence and courage. Again, not because of who we are, but because of who we are in relation to who He is. That is, at least if we're in good standing with our God. If not, we have pretty good reason to be concerned. Amos 3:2 in its entirety reads thusly. I only read the first half of it to you. Here's the rest of it, or the first part with the rest of it. Verse 2 of Amos 3, it says, "You only have I chosen among all the families of the earth." Boy, that's great, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking about just one race that He's chosen. We're talking about one lineage of one race out of all the lineages of all the other races. And He says, "I've chosen you out of all of them." We're a majority. The stars can't be numbered. But we're a minority when you see us in light of the rest of the world. And yet He's chosen us. And it's even narrowed down more, isn't it, under the New Covenant? Because this is applied under the New Covenant only to those who have returned to the Father through the Son. And so you really want to talk about a remnant. You want to talk something about feeling good about. You think about being that little, small, bitty, itty, bitty remnant that we are. I mean, you want to even go further with it. Look what specks we are as humans in this, or even this earth is in the universe. And then these little ants that crawl around that we are on the earth, and yet He's taken only a very, very, very small minority, minute part of it all, and said, "You're the ones I've chosen." Man, that's great. But listen to the rest of the verse. "You only have I chosen among all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities." There is also a price that comes with being God's chosen. Don't forget that either. However, if we, through the atoning sacrifice of Yeshua the Christ, are in good standing with God, we have good reason to be confident, bold, and courageous. But not only that, it should also instill within us a greater sense of our responsibility unto our God. It certainly did with Mordecai. In the apocryphal chapters of this book, being that's where this comes from, you can take it or leave it or do whatever you want with it, but let me share it with you. In the apocryphal chapters of this book, we find Mordecai appealing to God in this matter that we just read about in chapter 3. Here's what he states. "Thou knowest," in his prayer to God, "Thou knowest, Lord, that it was neither in contempt nor pride, nor for any desire of glory that I did not bow down to proud Haman. For I could have been content with goodwill for the salvation of Israel to kiss the soles of his feet. But I did this that I might not prefer the glory of man above the glory of God. Neither will I worship any but thee." End of that quote, or end of that prayer. Let it invoke the same response from us. It too, again, is a part of our heritage. Part of our heritage that's been lost to so many in Israel. Again, in that fashion, let's take back what belongs to us. Some of what's rightfully ours is not only our identity, and that certainly needs to be taken back, but the responsibility that comes with it. Let's take it back as well. Continuing, verses 5 and 6. Verse 5, "When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Now, let's stop right there. Don't miss this either. Not only does the knowledge of our identity have the capacity to fill us with courage and confidence, but it also can strike fear in the hearts of our enemies. Think about this. When someone decides to engage in war, or engage war with nations other than Israel, they have only the gods of Hamath, Arpad, Sepharvaim, Hena, and Eva to contend with, as King Sennacherib of Assyria put it. However, old King Sennacherib found out that it was something altogether different when dealing with Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, didn't he? Just one angel, as you all know, because I so often seem to come back to this illustration or this story, but just one angel of Yahweh in one night killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Just after old King Sennacherib had sent his man to Hezekiah to remind Hezekiah that, hey, don't forget about the kings of Sepharvaim and Eva and Havilah and whoever else. You know, they didn't stand a chance. You know, he mocked God, or he mocked the wrong God. He found out it was a whole different ball game when dealing with the God of the Israelites. So no wonder Haman became a little concerned when he discovered who it was he was dealing with in this Mordecai. Haman knew that he couldn't carry out his dastardly plans by his lonesome. First he goes to the lot, and then he goes to King Ahasuerus. Verses 6 through 8. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, or Judahites, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. I checked some commentaries on this particular verse, and it just for information here, it's not that he spent month after month for a year casting the lots. He, from the tense of the Hebrew here, it would appear that he was saying, it makes more sense, that on a particular day he cast until he came up with what he believed was the lot that he was being directed by, which landed on the 12th month, saying this is when it's to be carried out. Going on, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people, and they do not observe the king's laws." Now, I can't hardly continue without commenting on this accusation made by Haman. First, note that he accused the Israelites of having laws different from all other nations. Guilty as charged. That was certainly a truthful accusation. But why was that? Why was it an accurate accusation against the people of the Israelites? Well, because they were the only people on all the whole face of the earth who had been given Yahweh's laws. Turn to Psalms chapter 147. Psalm 147, verses 19 and 20. Verse 19, it says, "He declares his words to Jacob, his statutes and his ordinances to Israel." And then verse 20, he says, not only in verse 19 does he say that he declared them and gave them to Israel, but then he gets even more specific. He says, "He has not dealt thus with any nation, and for his ordinances they have not known them. Praise Yah." You know, some people would think that all the rest of the world is to have God's law, and someday they indeed will at least be under all of God's laws. But these people, David, whoever wrote this particular psalm, praised Yah that it was only Israel that had them. Again, it's one of the blessings of being his chosen people. The same is basically also recorded in the New Testament as well. In Romans chapter 9 and verses 3 and 4, it says, "For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from the Christ, for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption of sons, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the temple service, and the promises." So even under the New Testament, we see as well that it was Israel who had been given the laws of God. So that part of Haman's allegation was accurate. How about the second half of his accusation? He also said, along with that their laws are different than all other laws, he also stated that they do not observe the king's laws. So what do you think? Do you think the Judahites of Mordecai's day kept the king's laws or broke the king's laws? Was it true or was it a false accusation? Well, I think there were some who kept the king's laws, some who broke the king's laws, and some who kept and broke the king's laws. I'm completely confident that the vast majority of Israelites during Haman and Mordecai's time kept the King Ahasuerus' laws. Now, why do I say that? Well, knowing the history of the Israelites as recorded in the Bible, and having observed them in our times, Israelites seem to prefer keeping king's commandments rather than their God's commandments. That's just the way that it is. Today, such Israelites even have the sanction of their state 501c3 preachers who tell them that they must submit to all authority even when it's in contradiction to God's laws. On the other hand, I'm just as confident that there was a small remnant who zealously declared that they would submit to no man and who consequently rebelled against any and every law the king enacted. Now, some of you here today may relate to those who took such a stand. In other words, you might be relating yourself with the zealous, but also the spiritually immature, who have swung with the pendulum and overreacted to Judeo-Christianity's false doctrine of total submission to all government authority, and who find themselves in the opposite position and in rebellion to all authority. We've got our share of those as well, and I'm sure they did then. Then there were also those who, like Mordecai, both kept and broke the king's laws. Men and women who basically understood the correct interpretation of Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2, even though they weren't written yet. Those who understood proper authority structure. Those who understood that the king was to be submitted to in every area where he himself was submitted to Yahweh. However, who also understood that the king was to be opposed in every area in which he was in rebellion to Yahweh. I would to God that most of our churches today would understand such. Don't ever let some preacher try to tell you that Romans 13 demands that you submit to any and all government authority. But at the same time, don't let some patriot Christian, I didn't say Christian patriot, I said patriot Christian, try to convince you that you don't have to submit at all. The Apostle Paul in Romans 13 and the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 describes to us the kind of government we are to submit to. Now, I'll guarantee you that most of Judeo-Christianity, as most of you, if not all of you already know, is not teaching that from 1 Peter 3. They think they teach that. They think that indeed Paul and Peter are describing the type of government that we're to submit to. All government! That's not what Paul and Peter teaches so very clearly in those passages. But they do teach the kind of government we are to submit to. Those which, in a nutshell, support the righteous and punish the wicked. Not the wicked in the government's sight, the wicked in God's sight. You know, how much clearer can it get than the way Peter put it? He pretty much puts what Paul says in a nutshell. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 through 15. Let's go ahead and turn to there. We look at Romans 13 often, but not necessarily this particular passage. 1 Peter 2, beginning with verse 13. Listen to what it says. It says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to as a king, as one in authority, or to governors as sent by him." See? You're to submit, people, to all government authority. But it doesn't end there, does it? Verse 14. For the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. Yes, indeed. We're to submit to government authority when they punish evildoers and when they praise those who do right. Now, keep this in mind. There may be. Bill Clinton certainly doesn't fit the bill, does he? Neither any of his cronies. But there, I will guarantee, there are some laws that Bill Clinton either has or will enact, or ones that have been enacted in the past that he supports that are in line with God's laws. And in those areas, we are to submit to Bill Clinton or any other government authority over us, even if he is out of line in every other area in his life. But in that area, we are to submit to him rather than rebel against him, because in so doing, we're not submitting to him, we're submitting to God and his laws. Notice also how it continues in the next verse. It says, "For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men." You know, we've got our share of foolish men out there. And let me tell you, it's not all on their side. You know, there's enough of, we got our share of them on our side as well. But in other words, there is a time to rebel against law, and there's a time to submit to law. And you do it in a fashion so that you can silence the ignorance of those foolish men who say, "These Christians, they're just always in rebellion." No, I'm not. I will submit to any and everything that my government, where it lines up with my God, I will submit to them. And consequently, very possibly, I may be able to silence the ignorance of foolish men, or at least put them off for a while. So, Haman's accusation to the king was both truthful and misleading at the same time. And it's the same way today with the liberal media and such organizations as the ADL and how they work today. They do report some truths about us, but it's always mixed in with plenty of distortions and lies. Again, there's nothing new under the sun. We've got our share of Haman's today. Verse 8, back to Esther chapter 3. Esther 3, verse 8, it says, "Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws." Continuing, "So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain." What did Haman have in mind? Deportation? Hardly. Read on. "If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasury." I mean, old Haman, he wasn't just willing. He's just not promoting genocide here. He says, "Hey, I'm willing to pay for it." You might think, why would he be willing? Why would he want to do that? Well, there could be several reasons, but just contemplate that for a little while. What he was talking about here was extermination, genocide. And why shouldn't Haman the Edomite advance such an extreme measure, even to the point of being willing to pay for it? Why shouldn't he do so? Don't forget that he, as an Amalekite, along with his relatives, as descendants of Amalek, the firstborn son of Eliezer, who was the firstborn son of Esau, believed that they had legitimate claims to what the Israelites inherited, the birthright and blessings, from their father Jacob, who had, at least in their minds, stolen it from their father Esau. You keep that in mind when you're wanting to condemn old Haman. You know, here it is, that direct line from Esau, firstborn son line, as an Amalekite. You can see that he maybe literally knew that belonged to him, or maybe it was just instinctive. Either way, I don't know that we can blame or be as harsh on old Haman as sometimes we think. And not only that, don't forget that God had declared the same for them. That is extermination. genocide. God has said, wipe out those Amalekites. So don't think that Haman's response is so out of line. So why shouldn't Haman promote genocide? It was in his genes. It's called genetic imprinting. And they're starting to find out more and more, you know, with this trial of O.J. Simpson. They're talking about DNA. Well, what are they talking about? You know, genetic imprints. Imprints in the genes, in the DNA. It's the same thing that causes all homing pigeons to home, or generations of whooping cranes to follow the same migratory flight patterns as their ancestors. Genetic imprinting. Or in Haman's case, it might be called DNA race memory. Maybe he was enough generations removed that he literally, consciously didn't think about the birthright and blessings, as I'm sure many of the Hamans of today don't. But it was imprinted. I don't know why I'm pointing to my temple in my mind. I guess it could be, I could point to anywhere if it's in the DNA structure. It was imprinted. He couldn't help himself, and neither can the Hamans of today. Listen to this. I've used some of this before, but never in this light. I didn't even have it in my notes until late this morning. I was just so thankful that God reminded me of these quotes. Listen to the following admissions by an Edomite Jew. Maurice Samuel, in the book You Gentiles, which I carry, by the way, if anybody wants to order that from the Tate Ministry. Or here, I guess if any of you want to get it, it's quite a book. Maurice Samuel had this to say at several different spots. He said, "But another question, more subtle and disturbing, must be faced. I have said, there are two life forces in the world I know. Jewish and Gentile, ours and yours." And by the way, when he's speaking of Gentiles, he's speaking specifically of white Anglo-Saxon or Celto-Saxon peoples. Specifically, Christian. Maybe not dealing with Christianity here, but nonetheless, the difference between the races. "If this be a truth," he says, "we must not be driven from it." He then says, or later says, "Here is the Gentile life force. Here is the Jewish life force. What their origin was, I cannot say." So here's a man, he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand it, but he knows it exists. He knows there's a difference between the two. Genetic imprinting. He also says, "I can only affirm to the Jews in the main belongs the Jewish life force, a consistent and coherent force, a direction in human thought and reaction. To you others belongs the Gentile life force, a mode of life and thought distinct from ours." Also, he said, "Your outlook on life, your dominant reactions are the same today as they were 2,000 years ago." In other words, we've been genetically imprinted as well. Things about us have remained the same for thousands upon thousands of years. Also, he wrote, "I do not believe that this primal difference between Gentile and Jew is reconcilable. You and we may come to an understanding, never to a reconciliation. There will be irritation between us as long as we are in intimate contact. For nature and constitution and vision divide us from all of you forever. Not a mere conviction, not a mere language, not a mere difference of national or religious allegiance. With the best will on both sides, successful adaptation to each other will always be insecure and transient." And then also, "But as has come to pass so often, the difference which is deeper than will, deeper than conscience, genetic imprinting, will assert itself. There is a limit to our moral and mental possibilities. We cannot climb out of ourselves. The complete and permanent reconciliation of your way of life with ours is beyond that limit." And then also, "The misfortune is that the two are not merely different, they are opposed in mortal, though tacit, enmity. Our very radicalism is of a different temper. Our spur is a natural instinct. We do not have to uproot something in ourselves to become radicals, dreamers of social justice or socialism. We are this by instinct, genetic imprinting. We do not see it as something revolutionary at all. It is tacit with us. But with you, it is an effort and a wrench. Your very ancestry cries out against it in your blood." Genetic imprinting. And then lastly, he says, in everything we are destroyers, even in the instruments of destruction to which we turn for relief. End of quote. Amazing, amazing quotes. You know, they can't help themselves. Now, doesn't it make a little more sense of why Esau, even while in the womb, was hated by God? Turn to Romans 9. Sometimes people miss this, that even in the womb, Esau. We know that it says that Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, but it was even while in the womb that it was so. Romans chapter 9, verse starting with verse 10. Romans 9, verse 10. And not only this, but there was Rebekah also, when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose, according to his choice, might stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls, it was said to her, the older will serve the younger. Just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. What shall we say then? There is no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. For God says, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. But note that it's speaking of this even while the two twins were yet unborn, that God loved Jacob and hated Esau. It first appears unjust. And how many Judeo-Christians read this portion of Scripture and just really have a real problem with it? They don't understand it. It first seems unjust. But Yahweh in His omniscience could see the genetic trail and where it would lead. And same with Ammonites and Moabites and Canaanites from incestual lines. There was something about those lines that came from incest that he knew would be carried in their genes from that point on. And you read some of the history about the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Canaanites and their sexual perversions of their culture. God says, don't you ever marry with those people. Why? Because he knew the genetic trail. He knew the evil genetics which would be imprinted in this case upon Esau's descendants. Thus he declared that they should be exterminated. Puts a whole different light on this, doesn't it? All of a sudden you can see the sense of God. You can see God's mercy. You say, well, it's surely not merciful for him to wipe out a people. Well, it is if he can see that those people, the undue amount of harm that they will do on the rest of the world. You know, if you're some flaming liberal that has a hard time with putting a rapist or a murderer to death, then I don't even want to talk to you. You know, because you're not going to understand it. Because you don't understand justice and righteousness and the way things ought to be. You shout about how merciful your attitude toward things are when you want to keep the murderer alive so he can go out and kill other innocent victims. You don't understand. But if you understand that, then you ought to be able to understand that sometimes it may mean wiping out a whole race of murderers, a whole race of rapists, a whole race of who knows what, of Christian haters. All of a sudden, you can start to see. I'm amazed again. I know I've said it before, but I'm amazed at God's Word. It truly is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword. I didn't know that I'd understand any more about what it says there in Romans chapter 9. All of a sudden, now it's more meaning to it than I've ever seen before. And more appreciation for our God. Just how great, omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent he really is. But once again, note the consequences of disobedience. Because just one of our progenitors failed to obey God, God's plan is turned upside down, inside out. The tables are at least momentarily turned. And the very people who Israel should have exterminated are now planning to exterminate Israel. By the way, those in Acts 17 who complained that Christians were turning the world upside down were complaining only from their point of view. When in fact, the first century Christians weren't turning the world upside down. They were turning it right side up. They were simply turning it to where God designed it to be in the first place. It was the enemies of God who had turned the world upside down. But keep in mind, the Antichrist are only able to do so when the people of God disobey. It's the disobedience of God's people that opens the door for the enemies of God to take dominion. You know, we're quick to blame everybody else, but we better start pointing the finger back at us, and we better start, again, taking back what's ours, and that means responsibility unto our God. Old King Saul, he sure opened that door, and we're still contending with the consequences to this very day. Now, let's finish out. Back to Esther, and let's finish out chapter 3. Esther chapter 3, starting now with verse 10. It says, "Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and the enemy of the Jews, or Judahites. And the king said to Haman, 'The silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please.' Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written, just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Judahites, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder." Today, it's called Global 2000. Verses 14 and 15. "A copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out impelled by the king's command while the decree was issued in Susa the capital, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion." What was Mordecai and his people to do? Faced with extermination, outnumbered, outgunned, just what were they to do? What are we to do? Well, stay tuned for part 4 of Esther, Taking Back What's Ours. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, indeed, we're grateful to You. We're grateful, Father, that Your Word holds all that it does for those who will study deep into it. I'm thankful for the nuggets that You provide to me, and indeed, I, Father, look upon them as worth more than nuggets of gold or silver. Lord, I pray that the same would be true for our people, and those who hear this would be blessed and strengthened and encouraged, Father, in the lessons, Father, the instruction that's there in the book of Esther for our sake. Let us learn the lesson. Let us learn from our history, and let us not repeat the errors of our ancestors. Let us return, Father, unto You, and let us take back not only what's ours, but indeed what's more importantly Yours. We glorify You, we praise You, and we thank You for these things. In Yeshua the Christ, amen.